This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled, An Exciting Journey to Awakening. Simple tools that can awaken you to the truth of who you really are. Some of us don't want to know that, but my author is Mariah Brooks. Mariah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me the story behind the story. This book is a how-to helps book. What is your background and why did you feel inspired to write this particular book?
Well, my background basically is that I went through a lot of suffering in my life. And I have always wanted to help others to not suffer. So I started accumulating tools that helped me to feel better emotionally and physically, and tools that would also help me to remember who I really am. And this book came about and was inspired through who they call themselves, Divine Loving Beings. It was a channeled book, and it was basically downloaded in, I'd say, about 3 months. It had been coming to pass for a lot longer than that. Little bits and pieces were coming in. They gave me the outline. I wasn't sure how I was going to fill that outline in. And luckily, they helped me with that. And I went to a place in Florida. At the time, I was living in Florida. And I went to a retreat center. I was guided to go there. And I sat down with my notebook and my pen. And off they went. And I started writing. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And 3 months later, I wasn't there the whole 3 months. But 3 months later, out came An Exciting Journey to Awakening. And one of the things that they really wanted people on this planet to know is who they really are. Not who we've been taught that we are, not the beliefs that we've been given, the teachings, you're this, you're that, you're not this, you're not that. They didn't want that. They wanted us to know who we really are. And so they were basically the ones that inspired me to write this book, and they were pretty much the ones, well, no, we wrote it together, let's say, because I did a lot of work too, so, but we wrote it together.
Now, that's 48 chapters. Some individuals who are listening may not quite get the drift of your conversation, but there are some ideas in your book, a couple of chapters that I think a lot of people can relate to in one way or another. One is making a God box, turning it over. Explain that chapter. What does that refer to?
Making a God box is something that's really fun. It can be like going back to your arts and crafts days of making a box, a pretty little box that has a little top, a little slit in it. And you can decorate it any way you want. And in that box, you write down what it is that you are working with, what you're struggling with in your life. You write it down on a piece of paper, you fold it up, and you put it into your God box. And basically what that is you're turning it over to your divine. You're saying, God, universe, whatever you want to call it, I'm not able to handle this. I really need your help. Please help me. And you turn it over by putting it in the box and then let it go. Now, of course, it can come back to you, and your mind will bring it back up again. You can write it down again, put it into the box again, and let the divine take it.
Meditation and prayer are something a lot of people do relate to. You have a chapter on that. And you also have another one titled Trusting Your Process, which I'm assuming is one where we just relax and trust our judgment or trust our intuition. Is that a proper evaluation of what that is?
Pretty much. Trusting the process is that I believe, and I have also been shared with other teachers have shared this with me, that we chose a lot of the lessons that we wanted to learn before we came into this planet. And we also picked the people, the parents, the friends, the lovers, the situations that we wanted to happen so we could learn those lessons. And by trusting our process, we can trust that whatever we need next will be there on our journey to help us to grow, to help us to heal, to help us to learn the lessons that we want to learn.
And for the main message that's in your book, describe that for our listeners.
The main message in my book is to remember who you really are. We have been taught that we are these small selves. We are powerless. We're unable to take care of ourselves. We are victims of whatever happens to us, whatever comes along, and that is not true. So the main message that has come through my book is to remember who you really are. You are a part of the divine. You are love. You are light. You are a part of God. And you have God, the divine, universe, Buddha, nature, whatever you want to call it, living within every cell of your being. You can do whatever it is you want to do. You can create the life you want to create. And the other message was to take loving care of yourself. Take loving care of yourself emotionally. Take loving care of yourself physically. And treat your body, temple, your emotions and everything as it is, a temple.
Absolutely. And many of us, including talented people like me, or creatives, have a tendency to deal with negativity in their life because they're always trying to achieve something better than what they think they have now. How do you deal with that? What suggestions have you made in your book to get out of those slumps that human in general go through?
I do have a book, I do have a chapter in my book about living from spirit versus living from ego, living from your heart versus living from ego. Ego will tell you, oh my gosh, this is hard. Oh my gosh, I can't do this. Oh my gosh, I'm too small. I'm not smart enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not. And that is the negative that starts playing in our mind. I have shared in the book that the way we can get out of that is to go quietly into our heart. You can go into meditation, you can breathe into the heart, and ask your divine, help me to remember who I really am right now. Help me to walk in my greatness. Help me to be the light that I am. Please calm my mind and remind me. And that has really helped me to stop that negativity. Also, I've got chapters in here dealing with your beliefs, things that you have been taught. And looking and becoming aware of those beliefs, what they are, and are they working for you? And if they're not working for you, you can change them. You have the power to change those beliefs into beliefs that actually work for you. And that helps to stop the negativity also. And then one last thing, at the end of every chapter, I have listed affirmations. And affirmations are the truth of who you really are. And to say those affirmations over and over helps the mind to start getting a new groove of who you really are versus what you've been taught.
Tell us about the idea of a treasure map. What is a treasure map and how do we create one?
Oh, treasure maps are fun. Treasure maps are so much fun. Okay, what I do, and you can do it a few ways. You can get a poster board. You can get a small poster board, large poster board, or you can get a notebook, whichever way works for you. And you just go through magazines, through books, through advertisements, whatever it is that draws you, and cut them out. You may not know why you're cutting them out, but cut these out. It might be pictures of somebody walking in nature. It might be a picture of flowers or a picture of mountains, or and it could also, you need to cut out words or sentences that really speak to you. And I'm looking at my treasure map right now on my wall, and I have one that says feeling good, share your year to shine, live the life you've always wanted to live, connect with spirit. Anything that draws to you, just cut it out. And then you have all of your things. You have your board with some glue. And in the middle of your vision board or your treasure map, put whatever reminds you of God. It could be a scene in nature. It could be Jesus. It could be Buddha. It could be whatever reminds you of God. Put that in the center. And then on the outside, just start creating your board with maybe the left-hand side would have something about you choosing what it is you want to do for work. The right-hand side could be something about relationships. One of the lower sides could be something about health. The other lower side, maybe on the left, could be something that you're really wanting to create for the year. And just make it fun and glue all these things on there and then look at it every day and say some of the affirmations that are on there and picture and visualize your life being like this.
And then
you will start to create it.
Yeah, I've talked to many individuals in business who have a similar plan. They put down what their goals and aspirations are, and then they target their thinking and their thought process so that it achieves what they're looking for. Who do you think is going to find your book appealing and enjoy the read?
People that have really been drawn to it so far are people that are wanting to feel better emotionally and physically, and people that are basically wanting to get out of the ego that has been ruling their lives and start living in their greatness of who they really are. So basically spiritual seekers, people that are wanting to grow, are wanting to remember who they are, why they're here. Basically, that's who I'm targeting.
And there are other books in the marketplace that deal with similar topics. Why is yours unique?
Mine is unique for a few reasons. One is it is channeled material. Yes, there are other books out there that are too. But that is one reason. Mine is channeled material from divine loving beings that know the truth. And they're not in a belief system, but they actually know the truth. The second is I cover a multitude of topics. I don't get in depth with every topic because I couldn't, because they'd all be a book in themselves. But I have a multitude of topics that cover many, many ranges in a person's life, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, so people can take little bits and little pieces of each one or go to whichever one works for them. And the third is that I have many resources in my book, incredible resources that will help the reader to feel better emotionally and physically and also remember who they are. And at the end of every chapter, I do have affirmations and exercises to help them to practice and make real the chapter in their life.
Over 222 pages and 48 chapters. Mariah, were there any challenges in writing this, getting it to completion?
Not really. It seemed that way up until the 3 months when it started coming through to me and it just started coming out as I was writing. It seemed very slow and I got impatient and it's like, why can't I write this thing? And when it was time, it was time. And I'm learning that with other things in my life. When it's the right time, it's the right time. I needed somebody to transcribe it, and I just visualized that person. I didn't know who they were. And I just put it out there, put it in my God box, and that person showed up. I guess the one challenge that I could say was there was my ego. My ego would go, oh, God, this isn't good enough. Oh, who am I to do this? Oh, I can't do this. This is too big. That was the one challenge that I had to stay on top of because I had to keep going back into my heart and remembering who I really am and my intention. And my intention is to help people and to be love. And so that was my main one, was the ego.
The title of the book is An Exciting Journey to Awakening, Simple Tools That Can Awaken You to the Truth of Who You Really Are. our author, Mariah Brooks. Mariah, where can we get copies of your book?
You can go to BalboaPress.com, Amazon.com, and also BarnesandNoble.com.
And Mariah, do you also have a fan Facebook page?
Yes, I do. It is called Exciting Awakening.
And have you completed a website yet, or are you planning to launch one?
I am planning on launching one, and it should be up this week.
Fabulous. And our listeners can find you under Mariah Brooks, M-A-R-I-A-H, last name B-R-O-O-K-S. Mariah, thank you for sharing the background story into the completion of this book, An Exciting Journey to Awakening. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear the latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Altered Girl, One Woman's True Story of Confronting Clergy Sexual Abuse. And the author is C.M. Morgan, and C.M. joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, C.M.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for the call and the interview.
Well, great to have you with us. It's overwhelming, the subject we're going to talk about, but you're a brave, brave woman, and quite a story here of how, unfortunately, of course, as a little girl, you went through this despicable behavior by a priest, Catholic priest, which I'm sure you trusted at that time. And so it's your story, a 40-year journey of recovering from childhood sexual abuse from a clergyman, and how you confronted your perpetrator in the Roman Catholic Church with brave conviction. And I might say here right at the outset, and won your case. So that is an unimaginable journey for most of us. We couldn't even imagine what you've gone through. But we salute you for your courage to do it, because it needs to be done, doesn't it?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored. And yes, it does. It's an isolating type of abuse, dealing with clergy, and I actually never thought I'd be on this side of that litigation, or this side of having confronted my perpetrator. So it's been an amazing journey. Yeah.
Exactly. So how old were you when this all started?
Right around between 8 and 10, the abuse that I actually write about the book it is at 10 years old. But there were other incidences when we lived in New York before we moved to California, when I was younger, when I was 8, 9, by other priests maybe some seminarians there, I'm not sure, by other priests that were inappropriate with their behavior, yeah.
And at that time, being so young and, an active church member, family active? And
yeah, you know, it wasn't my choice to go to the church. This was something my parents chose for myself and my sister. So, we were going to church every Sunday, Catholic Mass, and when I was up until I was about 8 in New York. I was going to Catholic school, first through third grade. Then we had moved to Southern California, and it was there that my parents found another Catholic church for us to go to. And I was no longer going to Catholic school, but it was the Catholic church that we were going to every Sunday. And that's that the priest there, that's what I write about in my book, that priest there.
We're not going to go into the details. Your book doesn't go into the details of the sexual abuse, but it does go through all that you went through. And, you know, what happened after the abuse took place? Did you tell anybody about it? And what did they do?
That is such a good question. And the answer is, I don't know. When I started really... As a child, I know what I do know is I didn't tell anybody for quite some time. As I got older into my late teens, early 20s, I started getting into some therapy and started, because I always remembered it. So it's not like I forgot about it, you know.
Well, it's probably something you can't forget, right? It always is there.
No,
it's a nightmare,
no.
Obviously.
I mean, and I do understand some people have repressed memories around that, although that wasn't my situation. But when it came time for me to confront my, I started thinking of confronting him. I had actually asked my mom what she remembers about that time. I asked my dad what he remembers about that time. And they had two completely different stories. I asked one of my older sisters, and she had a third different story. So there's no validation, recognition about what actually occurred afterwards.
Now, did you tell your parents at the... When did you tell your parents, or if you ever did, when you were living at home?
I don't know. Eventually, it came out somehow. I have to tell you, between the clergy sexual abuse that went on and the own abuse that was going on at home. My father was a heavy drinker, alcoholic, mother, heavy codependent, a lot of violence in the home with yelling and hitting. There's so much that I don't remember about how things happened afterwards. Time gets kind of distorted when I look back in my childhood. What I do know is in my mid-20s is when I really started talking to my folks and my family about it, or a couple of sisters. And no one really had a straight story about anything, which was really unfortunate. And then it wasn't until later on when I started doing the started litigation against the church in my 40s. Two of my sisters didn't even know it ever occurred. I found out at that time. So a lot of family secrets, a lot of community secrets, you know, I think that happens a lot around clergy sexual abuse. It's the secrets that keep things progressing.
So you're 28 years old when you confront the perpetrator, this Catholic priest. Tell us about that event. That, I mean, must have been, my goodness, I can't imagine all the feelings that must have been racing through you trying to face this person.
Yeah, you know, I had gotten to a point in my life around my mid-20s that I thought, you know, my parents don't have the straight story. And really, it was only the perpetrator and I in those rooms when I was a child. And so sometimes I would doubt myself, thinking, am I making up this whole sick story? Did this really happen? I know something happened. I got to go find the perpetrator and ask him myself. I'm going to confront this guy. And I did some research, and I found him. And the details of this research, you can read in the book. It's actually very interesting how everything fell into place to make it possible to me to go knock on his door. And I did a lot of work with a friend of mine who was, she was a sheriff out in Marin County that had worked with pedophiles at the time. And so she counseled me on what possibly could happen, what good ways I could respond. I had a lot of support, but I did find him in Seattle. And what was interesting is I already had a trip planned that summer for Seattle. And so there he was already, you know. So a lot of things fell into place for that. You know, there's a saying I've heard that when you put your intentions out there, the universe conspires to support you. I've heard that. Mm-hmm. And that's truly the case for what happened in my mid-20s. I was 28. 28 is when I confronted him, when I finally knocked on his door. And it was intense. I did not get the response I thought, and I actually got to have an incredibly amazing conversation with him.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was. But I was prepared.
Hmm.
I wasn't prepared for him to be so responsive and to take responsibility and to admit his wrongdoings.
Oh my goodness. Well.
Yeah, that was something.
So then, it's quite a few years. Well, I think you've already said you were, let's see, how old were you when you decided to sue the Catholic Church?
I was 43 at the time. Because of the abuse that I write about in my book and the litigation happened in Southern California. In 2003, the state Supreme Court opened up lifted the statute of limitation for 1 year, inviting anyone that had a case against clergy or other sexual abuse as a child. In fact, it wasn't just against clergy, to go ahead and bring forth a case. And so I had started hearing about this on the radio, driving around, going to work. And I was, at first I would listen to the radio and I'd start to hear these reports and I'd turn the radio off thinking, I can't listen to this. And then a minute later, I'd turn it on and go, wait, I have to listen to this. No, I can't deal with it. Yes, I can. I would go back and forth. And then shortly after the statute of limitations was lifted, I got a call from my father, who, when you read the story, you'll see how that was really cathartic, that he was the one who presented the information, that he was working. My father's a psychologist. He was doing some psych evals for an attorney in Southern California, and my dad called me and said, hey, if you're interested, I'm working with an attorney you might want to call, and here's his number. And I sat on it for a few days, and I called this attorney, and he turned out to be one of them. They call him a super lawyer down there in Costa Mesa, and he was heading up some litigation against the Los Angeles Catholic Archdiocese. And so I called him, told the story, which was very difficult. I'd never told an adult, let alone an adult male, this story. You know, I've told a couple of friends, but no one in any kind of, you know, attorney power like that. And they flew me down to Costa Mesa, spent the weekend, did some psych evals, not with my dad, with another psychologist. Mm-hmm. And they saw my experience as credible. And then we went forth. And litigation lasted 5 years.
Wow.
Because church just kept bringing motion after motion after motion. They kept stalling. They kept getting new attorneys. I kept getting new interrogatories. And I have to write this stuff over and over again. It was a very challenging lawsuit. It was horrible, actually. Yeah.
Well, you say that clergy sexual abuse is pandemic, more widespread than most people know.
Yeah, it sure is. It's, I tell you, as a kid, because no one talked about it, I really thought I was the only one that ever knew about this. Now, of course, abusers, sexual abusers, and a lot of other perpetrators will tell their victims, you don't say a thing to anybody or else, right? So that was the case here. I didn't talk about it for quite some time. And I never heard about it. I never heard anybody dealing with this. And then when I confronted my perpetrator, I started hearing a little bit more about it. And then the statute of limitations was lifted. And then I realized, wow, there's a few of us out there. And then I realized there was a few more. So I started thinking, wow, it's a big deal in California. Well, then I had heard about what was had gone on in Boston. And the more I got involved with this case, the more I started reading and researching, and this is worldwide. There's cases happening in Ireland, Italy, Australia. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not just in the church I went to. It's not just right. LA. It's not California. It's not just the U.S. It's everywhere. There's an issue here with people and clergy. And, you know, it's not just Catholicism. this has been going on in the Mormon faith and other faiths, mm-hmm. other religions. They're really starting to flush all this out.
So you won the case, and then you went off to Australia. Why Australia?
Good question. You know, after the lawsuit was settled, right about the same time the lawsuit was settled, the relationship, I had been in a five-year relationship by then, and that relationship was breaking apart, was falling apart, and I just needed to get away, rest my head and rest my soul for a while. And I have a few friends that live in different parts of Australia, so I thought, you know, it's so far away, great place to go. And I just took off. I put all my stuff in storage, quit my job, and I spent 6 months traveling the country. One of the first books I read was that book Eat, Pray, Love, which was so perfect for my journey. And I read some other self-help books. I did quite a bit of writing, snorkeling, did quite a bit of scuba diving on the Great Barrier Reef, went hiking, went hang gliding, I learned to surf, met new friends, and just, you know, the past 5 years before that had been so intense. You know, I couldn't deal with the lawsuit every day, but every day things were coming up, or I was getting emails and phone calls once a week, once every month, a few times a month. And then my relationship was falling apart, and it was just, I was just not in a great place. So even though the lawsuit was won, we were at the end of the lawsuit, I was kind of at the end of my rope as well, emotionally, physically, mm-hmm. mentally. And so I just took off and did things I had never done before, like hang gliding. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing experience, hang gliding. You know, so that's what I did. I just got to relax back into my life again and find that spiritual center once again.
Well, just in the small amount of time we have left CM, tell us about forgiveness. Tell us about our history is not our destiny.
That quote, history not our destiny, I've heard it so many different times in my life, and so it had been brought, it comes into my life quite a bit, and I don't know where it's from, but it's certainly a message that I keep getting over and over again. And that, I gotta say, without forgiveness, for me, I don't have anything. If I don't forgive, it sits inside of me. I think we're all kind of born with this beautiful core of light and love that just can flourish and grow as we get older. And when we have the situations like sexual abuse as a young kid, it really kind of snuffs out that flame, and it's hard to get it back. But once we do get it back, I think certainly forgiveness is part of it, because I don't want to live in bitterness. I don't want to live in anger. I don't want to live in constant hurt. You know, I have a son. I have a newborn son now. He's 3 months old. My wife and I, she just delivered him 3 months ago. And what a bundle of love and light he is. And I never want his to get snuffed out. I want to see him grow. And for me, forgiveness is that part that I can fully love in my own home and in my own life without having this little ball of charcoal, black coal sitting there from the past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, letting go is one thing. You know, it's not something I can ever forget that happened, and it does spiral back, and sometimes hurt does come in. But, wow, do I feel clean inside? Because, you know, that perpetrator, I was eye to eye with that guy. I had a conversation with him, and it was a long conversation. And I saw that he was just like the rest of us, where he had a spirit of love that he was probably more than likely born with. And who knows what happened in his life to cause him to be that kind of person. But on the inside, I think he had at one point a great spirit, but he was a very damaged individual.
Hmm.
And I get that. I get that. So I think forgiveness, if I can't forgive, I can't live the life that I want to.
We've been listening to C.M. Morgan. She's the author of her book, Altered Girl, One Woman's True Story of Confronting Clergy Sexual Abuse. C.M., tell us, how do we get your book?
There's several ways. I actually have my own website. It's called it's titled darrenswork.com. DerrynsWork.com. I also Balboa Press set up a website for me, and I just got the book published, so I'm just learning how to use it. But if you go to Balboa Press and you just type in C.M. Morgan, you can find it there. It's also on Amazon eBooks, and it's just getting into bookstores. I just had my first reading and book signing this past weekend at Garrison Keillor's bookstore, Common Good Books in Minneapolis. I got to read with Norbert Kropf, who wrote a book called Catholic Boy Blues, I believe it is. And so it went really well. So hopefully I'll be doing some more readings and book signings. And I hope to actually tour this book. It's a pretty, I like to say it's an easy read on a hard subject. It's only 97 pages. But yeah, it's an easy read on a hard subject. So hopefully you can find it anywhere pretty soon.
Well, thank you so much, CM, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Steve Jorgensen and for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Our book today is titled Love, Lust, and Other Complications. It's a novel by P.M. George, and one of the co-authors, Dr. Janet Costin, is joining me today from Australia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I appreciate your taking time to visit with me and talk about your book. There are some actual reasons why you've chosen to write a book titled Love, Lust, and Other Complications. Dr. Costin, share the background reasons why you chose to write a book of this nature.
Well, there are two reasons. The first one is to do with listening to a radio program rather like this one, and in which a male author came on and said that female authors were unable to write good sex scenes. And because I'm an opinionated and somewhat competitive woman, I thought, oh, that can't be right. And I went up to my computer and wrote the scene that is essential to the novel and started me off.
Share some information about your primary character, the heroine in this story, or the primary characters.
She's an independent woman who has had to go through thick and thin to get to where she is now in regard to relationships. And I wanted to write, though, not just for the female reader, but also for males too. I guess that comes from my background as a psychologist and the privilege that I've had over these many years of listening to couples and how they negotiate the reefs and shoals of the marriage relationship.
Is there anything in this novel that's based on true fact, or has it just come from your imagination and your other co-author?
Well, I think it's a little bit more than imagination in that what comes through is combined stories from people that I've listened to over the years. So it it is a fiction in the sense that it's not based on any one life, but it's also true that it comes from sharing a part of the lives of many people who've talked with me.
This novel has, I guess, some lusty bits in it. Who would be the ideal audience that would enjoy reading this?
Well, when I wrote the lusty bits, I particularly wanted to address the stereotype that's often associated with older people, that they're sexless and that sex is something that they've put behind them once their mating period has finished and they've produced a family. And so I think that it's good for older people to read that and to see that life promises more at any age. But also I think younger people can learn that the stereotype is not right, and Sue and Mike are fit and healthy older people who get a lot out of life and a lot of enjoyment out of sex.
Fabulous. And the storyline, your characters, do they pursue careers, or is that a focal point of your novel?
No, it's not really. It's more that they're looking for something at the end of life. And fate takes a hand, and one morning, as one runs and the other walks along a cliff top, they bump into each other. Fate takes a hand. And from there, our relationship blossoms. That's quite lusty as well as intimate, and I suppose it helps them to continue to grow. I think that it's a hopeful novel in that it looks at growth at any age, and it suggests that you shouldn't just sit around and wait for fate to take a hand, but that you can give life a good shake as well.
The age of your main characters, what age range would they fall under?
They're closer to the end of life than the beginning, and I see them as around about the late 50s. However, that doesn't mean there's no relevance to younger readers.
This is a unique idea that you have co-authored this. What was the process of writing the storyline? Did you have an outline that you worked from, or did you just begin with inspiration and go from there?
We really just began with that sex scene and went from there, and what I hope that we have achieved together is that there's an authentic voice that's truly male there, as well as the heroine Sue's female voice. And I guess it comes out of my belief that there are differences in the way that males and females approach relationships, and particularly sexual ones, and that it's well worth having a look at those and being thoughtful about it.
Were you able to capture the essence of the male perspective, where it's more visual, as opposed to the female, where it's perhaps more embracing and more touchy-feely, I guess would be the way I would describe it, or emotion-driven?
Yeah, I'd go for touchy-feely too, and wanting things to be said, like I love you and all of those sorts of things,
yes.
Where the male is much more action man and shows his love through sex very often. And so sometimes misunderstandings occur just because of those different ways in how love is perceived.
And how long did it take you and your co-author to complete this novel?
More than 2 years. So it wasn't something we put together in a weekend. I think you'll find that there's things to think about it in, as well as just following the storyline of the main characters, and I suppose that's why it took a fairly long time to put it together.
Are there some underlying messages in your novel that are beyond just the excitement of the storyline?
I think so. I hope the book is about hope and optimism, especially for the older person, pointing that there's the possibility of more to come, even when you get to 50-60. That there's life still to be lived at that time, and particularly that relationship enables us to achieve happiness and fulfillment much of the time.
Online dating has become a big industry. Has that been addressed in your book, or how do you feel about the mysteries of online dating?
Yes, well, online dating is something that Sue plays with on the advice of her daughter. Her daughter's using online dating as well. And I think that the same sorts of difficulties can arise with online dating. Who do you trust? How do you know if you found the one? Those issues are there in the more traditional dating scene as well.
In your book, are there some, besides the obvious, evident focal point of the love and lust storyline, are there other exciting scenes that might stand out to the reader?
Well, my favorite one is when Sue gets her time on the computer confused and sends a rather sexy email to a daughter by mistake instead of to her budding partner, Mike.
Oops.
And it highlights, I hope, the differences that there is between the generations and how difficult it is often for younger people to accept that their parents are still sexual beings. And well, in this particular one, Kate, who is the daughter, says to her mother, I'll try and forget. I'll delete it from my computer, Mum, but I don't know if I can delete it from my mind.
I believe many of us who have lived for any length of time can relate to that situation. Some strange things happen occasionally. You just have to try to ignore them and go along with life.
Yes.
How would you introduce your book to someone?
Well, I want to ask them if they're interested in love and relationships and looking at them, and then whether the story of Mike and Sue fits their own experience of what having relationships is like. I guess writing about older people means that you can think about more than one relationship, whereas if you're thinking about very young people, then they haven't had time to have significant relationships and learn from the pathway on which they've been traveling.
Is there anything about this book that makes it unique? I think I know the answer to that, but I'm curious about your perspective on that as well.
Well, it's not a self-help book, even though I'm a psychologist, but I think it depicts some of the issues that often come up in relationships. And these two characters are positive ones, and they usually solve them after going through the bit of angst and conflict that we all experience from time to time. They learn that miscommunication need not be something that ruptures the relationship, and that there's many ways to repair things even when stuff goes wrong.
In your practice, there are, I'm sure, a lot of questions come up about how do I know when I found the right connection and the right one? Does that come up in your story as well, or is that something you address?
Yes, it does come up, and I guess trust is something that we all have to deal with because it often requires something of a leap of faith. The difficulty also being that the neurochemistry is likely to produce a state at the beginning of relationships, not only for young people, also for old people, of infatuation and rose-coloured glasses where faults and flaws are not very visible in the person that you're starting to become attached to.
What have you found about the differences between men and women as far as their expectations in a relationship?
I guess both want more, but they want more of something else. I think the generation of males that are represented here believe that marriage and relationship include sexuality, includes sex, and that's the main meal, as Mike likes to put it, or at least part of the main meal, whereas perhaps the female is looking, as you said at the beginning of this interview, for more intimate emotional moments, and she wants a lot said as well as some sexuality.
Stereotypes are prevalent. And in your practice, I'm sure they come up often when you're dealing with male and female and their expectations. What is your advice to individuals who have those expectations and are locked into those stereotypical approaches to life?
I guess it's to know yourself and be able to give that in a loving way to the person that you want to be with, and not to get hooked up on wanting more or seeing the other person as not giving what you expected. If you open up to the other and they to you, fulfillment really follows that, I think.
And where does the story take place? I'm assuming because you are in Australia, you probably have dealt with an area that's familiar to you. Is that the setting for this story?
Yes, it is. And of course, drawn to the sea, and quite a lot of the action takes place along the seaside strip near Melbourne, the capital city of Victoria, Australia. And it's a beautiful place, and any person anywhere is drawn to the ocean and its rhythms and the majesty of it. And to me, that completes the story to a certain extent.
Are there two or three words that might describe this in a kind of a nutshell or in a encapsulated form?
Well, I think it's a thinking novel. It is a romance, although maybe not the usual romance. I hope it's fun and entertaining.
224 pages. It's a novel that is the size of a read that I can personally focus on, so that's a good thing from my perspective. Were there any challenges in putting your book together, any challenges in getting it to completion?
The challenges were in having a collaborator to work with. That was both fun but a challenge, in that we too had to confront the expectations that we held about relationships, even though that was done from a writer's aspect rather than from the relationship aspect. And so many a good argument was had, and many a laugh as well.
The book is titled Love, Lust, and Other Complications, and it's a novel by P.M. George, which is a collaborative name of the authors. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Costin. Tell me, where can we get copies of this book?
It's available from Balboa Press, and which is a division of Hay House. It's also available on Amazon and Noble and Barnes.
Thank you again for joining me today. Again, the book title is Love, Lust, and Other Complications, a novel by P.M. George. Dr. Janet Costin, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Jay, for listening to me.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.